Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest is James Haywood Rowling, Jr. He's the chair of art education at Syracuse University and an expert on arts, education, and creativity. He has served on the board of directors of the National Art Education Association, and he's also the author of the soon-to-be-released book, Swarm Intelligence: What Nature Teaches Us About Shaping Creative Leadership. Professor Rowling, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity, Grant.
Well, your book starts with a very intriguing statement. After observing that most studies of creativity focus on the question of what creativity is, you say, as important as that question is, it will not be the primary focus of this book. Seeking its answer brings to mind climbing a fine and sturdy ladder raised against the wrong wall. Now, tell me more about what you mean there.
Well, I think the best way to put it is that understanding my context, which is as an arts educator, and discussions of creativity go on all the time, it became clear to me in the event that was the instigation for me writing the book, an opportunity to speak to another group of arts educators, that that question, even though it's at the center of lots of discussions about creativity, doesn't necessarily get us to the answer that I had begun sensing was really the best path to go. Mm-hmm. So I started off with a couple of other notions. Started off with the idea of where creativity was located in terms of the notion that it's not something that's boxed in our heads. It's also what its overall purpose was. I think a good place to start was, and I want to quote someone that I've written about in the book, or I've excerpted from the book, mm-hmm. Dr. James Borland from Teachers College, Columbia University, who was reflecting. He's an expert on giftedness, and he was reflecting on creativity. And he says, I'm not sure I have a definition of creativity. It's one of those human constructions that isn't discovered but invented. It's a word we use every day and makes perfect sense until you try to study it and you realize that when you try to separate out its constituent parts, that it gets more and more confusing. So, similarly, it was a confusing start for me, even though I'm immersed in the idea of what is creative and who is creative. But for me, I started off at a different place. Where is creativity located and why does it matter? And that started me off on the journey of writing the book.
Hmm. And tell me in a nutshell, what are the traditional frameworks out there for understanding what produces creativity?
Well, a good place to start is the what's often called the Torrance test for creativity, where folks tend to look at outcomes, divergent thinking, problem solving skills, that imaginative approaches to addressing a particular problem that are very much individual. But don't necessarily look at the context that developed the creativity. And this is the whole purpose of this particular book, which is to get at its inception, not so much at the outcomes, which if you don't have a general definition of creativity, makes it, if you really think about it, it becomes very difficult to test for it. And yet these tests exist, and it's actually akin to IQ tests. You wonder exactly what you're actually capturing. You're capturing something, but is it really what you the most useful data? So frameworks also tend to be connected with the kinds of processes, not just the kinds of processes, but the materials that creative individuals will, or mediums that creative individuals will use, whether it be visual or musical, or and looking at those frameworks. But once again, I'm much more interested in what sort of collides with the individual thinker and becomes the inception of whatever the creative output might be. And it could be well, you know, think about it this way. My creativity probably looks very different than your creativity. And we also we also have a lot of folks out there who don't think that they're creative at all. Mm. So my interest once again was looking at the inception, and I think I've
and you mentioned that. You mentioned IQ a few minutes ago, and that led me to want to ask you then, is the traditional approach in part this idea that some people are creative and some people not so much, that it's kind of – it's something that you're, if not born with, it's sort of just an aspect of who you are. Is that the way that most people think about this?
Yeah. And unfortunately, it becomes a big hindrance at a certain point because there's a mythology around creativity that if you believe that creativity looks like the lone individual genius, right, or that person who just does and thinks differently than everyone else, right, you miss the instances of creativity that happen every day in front of you. The act of learning how to compose a sentence, or the act of cooking an inventive meal, you know, or the act of solving a problem that is difficult, and these are all instances of creativity. But if we are looking through just the model that gets typically gets presented and over again in the media and in popular culture, we get lost and we don't see what's happening right in front of us.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with James Haywood Rowling, Jr., the author of Swarm Intelligence. And on that note of the title of your book, you've got this alternative approach to all this that you've been speaking about, which you base in something called swarm theory. Mm-hmm. So tell me what swarm theory is, mm-hmm. and how does it lead then to a swarm theory of intelligence and a swarm theory of creativity?
Okay, so maybe a good way to start there is I'll give you two models. One is a test that was a scientific test on a group of locusts thrown into a cylindrical bucket to see when, you know, what would be the thing or the impetus for them to begin swarming in one particular direction. Because when you throw them into this bucket, what they typically do is to start off by colliding with one another, climbing on top of on top of one another, getting nowhere fast. But what is it that causes the a mutually advantageous decision or to move in one general direction or to the beginning of a swarm, so to speak? So I want to say that, but also another useful model, I think, of a swarm behavior is it's taken from popular culture. There's this movie, a Disney film called Finding Nemo. Mm. And there's this the scene near the end of the film where it's a little clownfish. Nemo is trapped in a giant net that's being hauled out of the water with a bunch of silver grouper, a huge group of fish. And they are trapped. They're about to be raised out of the ocean to their doom. And ultimately, they're urged by Nemo to swim down together. Let's go down, because it's the only way we're going to save ourselves. And they swim down together, working all these organisms, working as a superorganism with one intent, to swim down. And ultimately, they snap the mast and they are freed. So those two stories get at this idea that there is a behavior in the natural kingdom. We see it all the time. We see it in flocks. We see it in herds. We see it in insect hordes. But also human beings tend to have the same collective intelligence that we see evidence of all the time. It's right in front of our faces, but we don't tend to notice it. And so the swarm theory and swarm intelligence has to do with this this collective adaptable ability to work together towards a common cause. And there are certain laws of the behavior that get swarms moving and keep them moving. the ability and willingness to chase after those in the lead, to separate from those that are too close for comfort, to sort of like align with those that are keeping pace right beside you, and to converge upon some sort of common goal. These are some of the features of this larger collective intelligence that is a place where individual achievement emerges from, but it starts with this collective interactive. We're social beings. Human beings are social beings just like other creatures. And we start with what we glean from those around us and from the context and the relationships with those around us. And then it becomes the inception for new thought or new purpose. Hence the title of the book. And typically, folks thinking about swarm theory have connected it with algorithmic and mathematical computational strategies in certain fields, but it's not typically looked at in terms of how human beings behave. That's where I draw upon, you know, this look at nature and natural social behavior and how that becomes a model for us to better behave together as opposed to behaving ourselves.
And so as part of your argument then that attention to the dynamics, the collective context of an individual's creativity is necessary then to really nurture the individual's creativity. I mean, how connect this to the emergence of creativity for me then, the swarm connection there.
So, to answer your question, looking at the contexts that surround us, very much becomes a key for finding and aligning ourselves with whatever grouping that we that best serves us. Let's put it this way: there's a chapter in the book where I talk about ancient secret societies, and I mention that. At some point or another, that I learned that I was a part of a group of individuals, a group of thinkers that tended to take their imagined worlds and put them on paper. I was an artist growing up. My father was an artist, and I grew up in an art studio in my home. I found that there are certain codes to that behavior. Artistic behavior it's not just a gift. It's a behavior. It's a chosen, selected behavior that produces ideas and avenues for thinking and ways of doing. For me, having a sense of what group, and this can be applied to schools. Could be applied to workplaces, any place where there's a school of thought to be followed. Identifying the patterns that you are interested in replicating and or adapting is very key to finding the those that you are looking to swim with, so to speak, to exercising this ability to think and behave together and towards some sort of mutual advantage.
And I also was curious to know, thinking of other related research that I've read in recent years, I'm wondering whether this goes against the grain of some of it. For example, I recall reading that group brainstorming sessions, which seemed to speak to the swarm idea in some ways. Mm-hmm. That they've been found not to be as effective as many people assume, as opposed to the individual going off by his or herself and just kind of thinking through whatever the issue is. Is there a tension there with what you're doing and some of the other tenets of research that's going on now on this?
Well, it's always important not to throw out one mode of successful thinking for another. I'm not advocating or suggesting that there is no such thing as individual achievement, not at all. It's quite the opposite. What I'm saying is that there's a place that is common to all of us And we, in the same way that Vygotsky talks about a zone of proximal development, where we learn because we are guided by our interactions with others who know how to do or think in that way before we have learned how to do or think in that way. We start by learning what's out there, and it starts elsewhere. Our creativity is someone else's creativity before it becomes ours. Right, we're born pretty helpless, right? As we encounter and have encounters with others that we choose to align with, because it's an intelligent decision. We're not like locusts. We can be very intentional with these decisions. We find ourselves, we find ourselves surrounded by catalysts. Right, for our individual goals and achievements. So groupthink, and you raise a good point there. Groupthink actually can be very dangerous. There's such a thing called mob mentality, right? I'm not talking about some sort of panacea here. Good reasons to pull apart and separate from the crowd, so to speak, and that's actually a part of swarm behavior, separating from those that have become too close for comfort. There's a good reason and there's a good time to pull away, but there are other laws that are always at work within any swarm as it achieves the development of whatever its paths or goals might be. So groupthink is okay. It's for certain situations, and other times it's actually a hindrance. I agree with you on that, and agree with those that kind of I guess at a certain point it depends on at what point you're looking at within this. Research can be very much as a snapshot, and at a certain point one might look at that and say, well, that's a good thing, and at another point it might be not the thing that's needed to advance everyone along.
My guest is Professor James Haywood Rowling, Jr. He's the chair of art education at Syracuse University and the author of Swarm Intelligence, What Nature Teaches Us About Shaping Creative Leadership. Well, what is the implication then of your work for the way that we need to teach kids in schools?
Well, the larger implication has to do, and it's something I addressed earlier on in the book, are the many ways that schools, as they are currently designed, actually underdevelop creativity, because this is not something I'm not the first person to talk about this. Sir Kenneth Robinson talks about this in terms of discussing what creativity is and how schools can best address it as well. But I am echoing, I think, that tend to look at schools as ways to create conforming behaviors, the hierarchies and that tend to exist in the way schooling is designed tend to mitigate the opportunities for some of the decentralized approaches, decentralized control, distributed problem solving, the kinds of interactions that need to take place within swarms that allow for divergent outcomes and adaptations to take place. One of the notions I get at it in the book is this idea of education without borders, and I use a particular example. If you think about the Khan Academy, where folks come to online to look at a particular batch of learning initiatives, whether it be in mathematics or whatever field of study you're interested in, and sort of come to it, learn what they can, and then take it and go away, so to speak, and use it in whatever venue that they are living in and operating in. It's not so much about preparing students for some uniform goal, but it's allowing students to come draw upon, like bees drawing pollen from a basket, and take it wherever they're going. And it's much less controlled than typical schooling tends to be.
So the hierarchy then is getting in the way of the swarm.
Yes, exactly.
To put it really simply.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so building off of that, I'm going to make a confession here to you.
Yeah.
I hated group projects in school, and I was a pretty good student. And my experience was that they often seemed to be a waste of time or a showcase for free rider students in the group.
Mm-hmm.
So what was I missing there? Is there an implication for swarm theory in thinking about that?
Yeah, I think so. I use an example in the book. I used to be an elementary school art teacher, and I used an example of a group of kids that I was working with, many of whom nobody would have identified as being creative, but yet some wonderful projects came out of it. And I'll say that I don't know exactly what the setup for your group projects were, but ideally, the notion of working together as a group is not to come at some to arrive at some uniform outcome that looks exactly the same out of everyone's hands. But it's more about the opportunity to sort of collide with one another, right? To allow for, using a billiard table analogy, unexpected things to happen. If it's controlled, we're talking about that hierarchy again. Mm-hmm. If it's controlled to the extent that the unexpected is not allowed to happen, then group work can be a waste of time. But if you allow a group to assemble and allow for the unexpected to happen, if you've ever seen pictures of say a swarm of starlings in the air, spinning away suddenly from a hawk that comes, and all of a sudden it looks like they're all moving at the same time. It looks like the group is doing exactly the same thing, but really there are a bunch of individualized choices that are taking place as each spins off and is attempting to at the same time separate and chase and to not collide and yet converge at away from a target or toward a target. That's the dynamic which is fascinating about the group project. And oftentimes it's conceived in entirely the wrong way, and that might be the thing that you hated when you were a student.
In case you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm talking with education and creativity expert James Haywood Rowling, Jr. Well, you're an arts education person.
Mm-hmm.
It would seem that of all of the different areas of education and endeavors, that artistic creation would be the one that would be more amenable to this lone creator model. So say more about how the theory works with the realm of artistic creation, because, again, that's where it's most counterintuitive, it seems to me.
That's where it seems. It seems to be the case. But say, you know, our classic example of the lone individual genius is Leonardo da Vinci. And there's a point in the book where I talk about the fact that he spent much of his adolescence working in the studio of I think that the fellow was named Verrocchio, learning mediums and materials and working with other famous artists of the time. We don't see that period of time. We don't talk about that period of time before he sort of split off from the group and began to emerge as an individual in terms of his individual achievements. But there was a time where he was contributing to the workshop, and that was the place where the origins of his individual genius can easily be traced to. So even in the arts, where we oftentimes and mind you, if you are in the arts and if you're familiar with artistic processes today, you find out that artists will not shy away from talking about the group and team aspect of putting together a photographic collection or working on a large mural. It's not just about the individual person. There's a lot of contributions that take place within the arts. A perfect example is jazz, right? Which is identified as one of the main American art forms. And yes, we do know of the individual geniuses, but they were all without without exclusion. It all started for all of them in this, in the collective activity of jazz making and musical that search for musical meaning. This is where ultimately where I am attempting to go with this is to expand the conversation beyond talking about his creativity or her creativity, but more about our creativity, right?
And I want to take this question of artistic creation mm-hmm. in a different direction. There's a claim that I have heard mm-hmm. Many times about it, that it's pain and suffering, mm-hmm. it's challenge, it's cultural oppression even, that these are the things that tend to stimulate better artistic creations than peace, happiness, stability. And this is true both for individuals and collectively for peoples or groups. And, you know, the list mm-hmm. of examples in this vein are endless, of the tortured individuals that become the great artists and the great mm-hmm. musicians and so on. So what's your take on that? Is there a connection there?
Well, what I would say is that the arts are about life and identity. And whatever it is, the arts are not there's great art about suffering, right? There's also great art about angst and ambiguity and about happiness and joy and love and relationships. It's about who we are, and ultimately the arts are a place where we make those meanings visible for others to hopefully swarm along with, so to speak, and in terms of expressing what it is to be human, right, which is extremely complex. So there is the notion, once again, we're talking about mythologies. When we think about the archer, the artist as a tortured genius, mm-hmm. right? Oftentimes the arts, if you're a practitioner, is some of the most fulfilling things you'll ever have an opportunity to do in terms of the practices and the disciplines that are involved with it. You know, it goes along with the idea of flow theory, right? The idea of finding that thing that you zone in on and that where you feel like you are fully alive, right? So that there's nothing tortured about feeling fully alive, right? So there is a range there, and it's important to tell the whole story and to which is, you know, why we want to identify the myths that are involved with the discussion about the arts and creativity.
And what about your own creative process and coming up with and developing your argument about creativity? Mm-hmm. Did that process fit your theory?
That's a good question. I think so, because for me, I started – you have to understand that I started off as a visual artist. I consider myself I have other pursuits. I sing. I write. I've written poetry since I was in high school. For me, and obviously as a scholar, I write for academic audiences. When I began writing about creativity, I realized that, wait a minute, this is for a larger audience, because this has implications not just for the small group of scholars who might read a journal that I might write in. And it was unexpected in terms of the sources that I began to turn to in terms of looking at complexity theory, systems theory, swarm theory. Typically aren't – that's not really the trafficked by that – those kinds of readings are not trafficked by arts educators. But this journey in terms of understanding the social origins of creativity took me there. Hmm. And I had to make sense and synthesize this information and try to bring it back to ultimately where the book goes, is to rethinking what creativity is. It takes us through this journey about leadership and social behaviors, that social networking behaviors that cause us to develop as human beings. But really, I started off with the question of creativity, and I think I ended with a rethinking of what creativity is in a way that I think will be helpful not just in arts applications towards the arts, but also in the sciences, in the workplace, in schools, and hopefully in diverse realms.
Let me get to the three questions. What's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
Exploration of the the next chapter, actually, the exploration of the next chapter.
Second, what's your worst trait?
Suppose my worst trait is a sense of sometimes I have a sense of striving a little bit too hard to prove myself to myself. In other words, I'm a little bit of too much self-doubt. I've accomplished quite a bit, and yet sometimes you wonder if you are doing all that you can to serve humanity, so to speak. It's a big question. I wrestle with the big questions a little bit too often, right?
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
I think that I'm most surprised that starting off as a visual artist, I've ended up as an educator, right? And even there, my audience keeps on expanding beyond what I thought it would be. I remember I was once just an art teacher in an elementary school classroom. So, and you know, it's been an interesting journey.
That was James Haywood Rowling Jr., and his new book is called Swarm Intelligence, What Nature Teaches Us About Shaping Creative Leadership. You can pre-order it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other online book shopping sites. Professor Rowling, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you so much, Grant, for having me.
For a longer version of the interview you just heard, go to WRVO.org, and please also join me again next week on WRVO Public Media for more conversation in the public interest.